fans everywhere. My name is Michael LeColin, also known as the Brooklyn Trolley Blogger, and on behalf of my partners, I welcome you to a getaway day episode of the Mets Fan Podcast. We have the club's first somewhat major controversy of the season to discuss, as well as the wacky series against Philadelphia and today's concluded series versus St. Louis. We have pitching, hitting, defense. They're all on the docket, so let's get started. Hailing from Connecticut, CT Mets fan. You can get him on Twitter at MetFanRich. You can also read his work at MetsMorized Online. Rich Spirago. Hello, my friend.
Hello, Mike. How are you tonight? It's another interesting day, another interesting week in Metsville. Looking forward to unpacking it with you.
Absolutely, always. And how's the family, sir? You know, we fail to do that sometimes.
Everybody's good, you know, and it's interesting how our conversations have changed over the last, 15 months, where everybody's healthy, and while that was always important, now it hits a little closer to home. So, yes, thank you for asking. Everybody's healthy, and that's all that counts.
Excellent. And our president of podcast operations, he's somewhat like Carmen Sandiego. We never know quite where he is at any given time. He's the converted Mets fan, Sam Maxwell. He's also the proprietor of Bedford and Sullivan podcast. Hello, Sam. How are you, sir?
What is going on? Good to be here. I'm not in Manhattan this time. I did say I'd throw a curveball, but it's really not a curveball. It's definitely a fastball down the middle. It's New Jersey. So,
I think if you were raising kids in the 90s, you know who Carmen Sandiego is. Otherwise, well, look it up. Our featured guest this evening is esteemed baseball columnist from the New York Newsday. He's Mr. David Lennon. Good evening, welcome, and thank you for joining us on our podcast this evening, sir. Hello.
Hey, guys. Like I said, thank you very much for the invitation tonight. And it's hard to believe that we're over a month into the season already. It's flown by.
It really has. As they say, time flies when you're having fun. Let's jump right in. Obviously, the major story of the week was the firing of Chili Davis and Tom Slater, the hitting coach and the assistant hitting coach, or batting assistant, put that in quotes, of the New York Mets. Mr. Lennon, I like to start at the top. I'm going to start with Sandy Alderson. This is his front office, and I bring into question his handling of the situation. You wrote, I believe it was the day before last, that Alderson committed to this decision during the Boston series. And you would think, why not? They struck out nearly in half their at-bats. But Sandy Alderson, was never agreeable with Chili Davis in the first place, so why let him start the season as coach?
Yeah, I think in doing a little reporting about that as the story kind of progressed over the 2 days or so around the firings, that was a question that came up in some people that I spoke with, and really the answer was that before the season started, they felt they really couldn't find somebody to take over that they liked. I mean, listen, we all know what the front office situation was after Steve Cohen, that the sale of the team went through in early November. It was always kind of in flux. I mean, he had Sandy as the president, but it took some time to get a GM and Jared Porter. And then you got the assistant GM and Zach Scott. Then you didn't have the GM anymore in Jared Porter. And then you had the interim GM or acting GM and Zach Scott. So there's a lot of moving pieces here. And I think in this case, they gave Louis Rojas the bench coach that he liked in Dave Jouse. They didn't really do a heck of a lot else. They decided to leave the other people in place, given some more time and a little more stability, it seems. They would have sought out some other candidates for the hitting position. As we know, Scott isn't necessarily a big fan of Chili Davis, having been part of the crew that fired him in Boston. So I think they went into it thinking, okay, we're not totally on board with Chili's kind of old school mentality, the contact mentality, not the launch angle guy, but let's go into the season and see how things go. Let's see if he kind of picks up more on what we want him to pick up on. And they kind of begrudgingly went into the season with it to see how it would go. You know, that said, you know, if things went great, you know, you wouldn't be seeing the switch at this time. But when you saw the team really kind of stumble out of the blocks offensively, you know, the Boston series and what had kind of led into it kind of gave them the window for that. I mean, in that Boston series, and I had talked to some people with the team about it, those at-bats were awful. I mean, you can look at the results were bad enough, sure. I mean, they scored one run in two games. But really, the at-bats were clueless. It was like they had never even seen a curveball before, and they got a steady diet of them during those two games. You know, that's when they decided, you know what, we wanted to make a change before now. Now we have the chance to do it. What they've said is that logistically they couldn't get these two guys in place until after the weekend. Quattlebaum had some personal issues. Howard had some things that he had to settle. And they did it rather abruptly at midnight after a game on Monday, which, again, the timing of that, I question. It's not the first time we've seen that with the Mets. It probably won't be the last. But anyway, that's kind of the backstory, why they made the decision when they did. That's the official, you know, behind-the-scenes recollection of it. Whether it's 100% true, whether the truth lies somewhere in the middle, I think that still is out there.
Today's game was indeed rather interesting. They set a record today, but before we take this conversation onto the field, we're going to keep this right here. You mentioned two role players in this latest drama, Zach Scott, Luis Rojas. I think Pete Alonso is a player in this drama as well. We'll speak of him. But for the moment, please, Mr. Lennon, I will ask, towards the truth or the fallacy that Sandy Alderson was necessary, a key component in Mr. Cohen purchasing the team and getting approval from the other owners? Because I think this is what really opens up a can of worms.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a big part of it. I mean, I think Sandy is a very trusted and respected guy among Major League Baseball. He's worked for Major League Baseball in a significant capacity, a trusted kind of lieutenant to C-League, and knows Manfred very well, and also is known around the games by the other owners. And I think Cohen, as an outsider, where, you know, the other owners didn't know very well, really had to kind of show that, you know, he kind of had a foundation in place and had a real baseball man in place, and this was going to be more than just a guy worth $15 billion, a Mets fan, buying the team. They wanted to see some stability there, and I think Sandy is a big part of that. I think we saw that from the jump when the sale went through, and Sandy was very much part of the news conference with Steve, and I think you've seen that moving forward. You know, I wondered at times with the Jared Porter situation if that put Sandy in a little bit of hot water, since that was his choice and Steve trusted him to do that. But as far as I can tell right now, they seem to be in good stead. You know, I wonder if Sandy knew what was going to lie ahead for him in this rocky road with what the team has come under with a lot of these sexual harassment claims and other discriminatory claims. If he would have decided to come back for this, it's been quite a situation he's been in addressing these things, whether it's with Mickey Callaway or with Porter. But, you know, I think he's been important to be installed as president and really kind of tried to add some stability there.
So, Rich, we've had this discussion before. When Steve Cohen purchased the team back in November, I questioned the rush to hire Sandy Alderson. Not that I begrudge him, not that I didn't want him. As a fan, I merely say that been there, done that. That's my perspective. Been there, done that. I don't like to move backward. I like to move forward. I also questioned what was the rush, because upon his purchase of the team, Rich, I think the position of president of baseball operations for the New York Mets became one of the elite positions in all of Major League Baseball. But I say he hastily invited Sandy Alderson back into the fold. Now, again, that's just opinion. But my question to you, Rich, or is it me, does it seem like the Mets are still operating in a distinct Wilponian manner with all the idiosyncrasies and certain situations that have gone on? And, you know, the common denominator here between regimes, the old regime and this regime, the common denominator is now Sandy Alderson. Take it away, Rich.
Well, I think you raised some good points there, Mike, because, you know, firing a hitting coach and other coaches is not – it's not unprecedented in baseball. Yes, this is a little bit sooner, but, you know, I think back to Bobby Valentine, and, you know, and we've all talked about that. Bobby Valentine had basically his entire coaching staff gutted in 1999. The team had lost a bunch of games in a row. They were at Yankee Stadium. And all of a sudden, okay, Bobby, you know, now you have all new coaches. How do you like that? So that stuff happens in the game. That didn't really bother me. That's the course of business. But to your point, when I heard Pete Alonso saying, I heard about it and I saw it on social media. I went back to my locker and cried. All these other guys are finding out in all these back channel kind of ways. It was done at midnight after a game. It's kind of, you're exactly right. It's like, wait a minute. This is Wilpon era stuff. You know, I think one of the reasons, I mean, Sandy was brought in for several reasons, but one of those reasons was professionalism, right? A guy that everybody respects, you know, does things the right way and above board kind of guy. And yeah, this may have been Zach Scott. I don't know. And, you know, and David talked about timing, about guys having to get COVID tests and all that to be able to join the team. And I understand all that. But the fact that you have players going to, you know, going on press conferences, or you're going on Zoom with folks like David saying, yeah, I found out about it on social media. I went back to my locker and cried. That's just Bush League, and I'm sorry, it is. It reeks of being Bush League, and that's the kind of stuff that you were hoping, or we were hoping, that by bringing Sandy Alderson in, again, what's one of his main benefits? Professionalism, running a tight ship, all that kind of thing. I had flashbacks to the Wilpon era, just like you said. You know, and just one thing on Chili Davis himself, these guys come and go. I'm not particularly worried about it. I'm not going to say it was the right thing to do, the wrong thing to do, but Chili Davis purports to be a guy who talks about batting average, you know, like David said, not launch angle, you know, kind of eschewing the current thinking. Well, he purports to do that. Last year, the Mets led Major League Baseball in batting average at .272. And, you know, the guy says that's his approach, and it worked. It did work. And then they were second in Major League Baseball in OBP with .348. Okay, you know, what this guy says he does, he actually did. He delivered on it. Now, the issue last year was they were 23rd with runners in scoring position, you know, batting average, runners in scoring position. So whether that's on him or not, who knows? But I don't know. I just thought I would share that, you know, the guy's there to do a thing that he says he's going to do, and he did it.
All right, Sam, put Sandy Alderson to bed. He's in charge. This is his front office. What's your take?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that were just brought up. We were talking about the discriminatory stuff, and I just want to get this part off my chest right away, because you can't forget the comment of the statute of limitations, as well as, okay, I'll tell Randy Newman to knock it off. That reeks of old boys club behavior, that reeks of perpetuating the same thought process that has led to this stuff, this toxic environment that mostly women have talked about, but a lot of men have recognized, and it needs to change. And that is, you know, when you're talking about whether or not you needed to bring Sandy Alderson back, Mike, you know, I think that Sandy Alderson didn't do himself favors in my book, especially considering that when he did originally go out, albeit under the cancer element, I did think at that point that the game had caught up to him a little bit. And I think that I do like a lot of ways that they've assembled this team this year. However, he hasn't done himself favors in showing that he's adaptable, even though, you know, analytics is one of his big things, and that's why Chili Davis got fired. Now, the one thing about the LOB part is the fact that this has been an issue with the Mets since 1962. As we've famously, infamously talked about, you know, they lost 50 games where they had the tying run on deck or on base. So this is something that I think in the short term, that if we're talking about Steve Cohen coming in here and changing the perception of the New York Mets as a franchise, because that's what we're that's what this entire offseason has really technically been about. I think when you're talking about that, you have to start right with the LOB part, and we'll kind of dive into that when we're talking about the game.
Well, let's do that, because analytics are on the table. Zach Scott, Mr. Lennon, what do you think his prospects are of shedding the interim tag and becoming the official general manager?
Well, I guess that largely has to do how this team does this year. You know, I mean, this
Agreed.
Was a, you know, results-oriented business, despite Zach Scott saying that this decision was, the Chili decision was not, quote-unquote, results-oriented. But, yeah, I mean, you keep your job when the team wins. So if the Mets, you know, wind up becoming a playoff team, I think Scott's in pretty good shape. You know, there's a pretty good reason to bring him back. That means that he's probably made one or two moves during the season to polish up this roster, which, let's face it, before the season began, I thought this was going to be a good team. I thought this was a team that was capable of winning 90 games. I thought they had the pitching depth. I thought they improved their bullpen enough. I thought their lineup would certainly be productive. So I can't really give Sandy and Zach Scott a hard time at this point, because I think it's a roster that's put together that should win. It's a 500 team right now, which is not really what people expected, and this offense is something to behold, to put it mildly. But, yeah, I mean, Scott's, you know, prospects of holding on to this job is going to be tied into how the Mets do. If the Mets do poorly and don't make the playoffs, they'll be looking for another GM. If not, if they do make the playoffs and do well, and even if they're in a playoff position later in the season, you know, you could see that solidified. So, I mean, this is a team that could use some more help in the front office. Their front office is pretty lean right now. You know, they could use some more people to help out Zach Scott in that regard, too. So I think this is still a front office that is still a work in progress. So I think you will see some other names added. Whether or not Scott heads that team of people depends on these next few months going forward and how this team rebounds.
And fans want to know, you know, I have to play the role of contrarian and bring everything up. Is Luis Rojas on the hot seat? There's the matters of scapegoating, and you can clarify that for us. Rojas is not an Alderson hire, and today he managed only his 86th game of over parts of two seasons.
Yeah, the Rojas question is interesting, and I was a proponent of bringing him back only because of the craziness of his first season. I mean, you're talking about a pandemic. You know, you're talking about the season being interrupted twice, you know, a 60-game season. Extremely difficult under those circumstances to manage a baseball team anyway, regardless of the fact that you're a rookie manager. That said, coming into this year, all bets are off. You know, he doesn't have a contract beyond this year. And I think it's very important to note that Chili Davis and Slater were both fired, basically, well, the decision was made without Rojas's input. They were basically just taken out from under him, and him basically being told, you know, before Monday's game that they were being fired afterwards. So, you know, those weren't Scott's guys, Sandy's either. And Rojas isn't. I mean, Sandy knew Rojas from his time as GM before, but he was not his managerial hire. And same goes with Scott. So there's a lot of signs pointing to, if this team continues to struggle, you know, they're not tied to Rojas at all. And somebody is going to have to take responsibility for this team underperforming. And when a team underperforms, and again, this is not a fault of Rojas, he's still new at this, you know, you kind of need somebody out front that can kind of handle the PR aspect of it. And Rojas, being new at the job, you know, isn't particularly adept at that. You know, he doesn't have the skills of an Aaron Boone, who, when the Yankees are struggling, look terrible and people are taking them apart, can massage things or make things, or, you know, make things more consumable for an angry public. You know, Rojas doesn't have that skill. You know, he wasn't an ESPN broadcaster like Boone, and it's just not in his way to do it. And I just wonder, I mean, he has a lot of friends in that clubhouse because he was on the developmental side with them. Team goes south, those connections, you know, get lost with players very quickly. And, you know, it's something to watch closely as we move forward. These next few weeks are a very volatile time. You know, they have new hitting coaches in. Let's see if they make much of a difference. You know, they're going to have to wait longer on Carrasco now. You know, DeGrom, is he okay? So these next few weeks are volatile weeks for the Mets. And in saying that, are volatile weeks for Luis Rojas, I think.
And we'll wrap up this segment. What Hugh Quattlebaum and Kevin Howard are not familiar names to us fans. Anything that you can add insofar as insight to these gentlemen?
Well, I mean, Quattlebaum has connections with Scott, knowing him through the Boston organization. And that was really, you know, that's somebody that you know. Howard is somebody who knew Lindor through their time in Cleveland. Not very well, it seems, from what Lindor has said. But, you know, these are ingredients to what led to them coming on board. You know, you get the front office hires people who they know. You know, can I tell you how successful Hugh Quattlebaum is going to be as a hitting coach? Honestly, I can't. You know, I don't know what type of connections he's going to be able to make with the players. I don't know what techniques he uses. I see that he's been a disciple of Walt Riniak. I can say that growing up in Boston that I had went to Walt Riniak's hitting camp a number of times in my youth. So I know the Walt Riniak hitting style. whether that's successful in 2021, I knew Rich Gedman caught a lot of flack for being a Walt Riniak disciple. So that goes way back and probably not of interest to your audience right now. But, you know, these are things we just don't really – I can't provide any additional insight there. We'll see how he does. I mean, he certainly has taught them how to take a pitch, as we saw in today's game. But beyond that, I think we're going to have to watch and see what the results are.
And for those who don't know, first baseman Frank Thomas, he built a Hall of Fame career using Walt Riniak's hitting style. So there's something to that, you know, but it's all relative. You're listening to the Metsian Podcast. I'm Michael LeCollin. My partners are Sam Maxwell and Rich Sparago. Our featured guest this evening is New York Newsday's David Lennon. Sir, I will ask you to take us back. Once upon a time, there was a 9-year-old who used to frolic around Fenway Park. He used to wear a T-shirt with Jim Rice on it and saying, if I remember correctly, if you want to face Rice, pitchers must pay the price. How did that 9-year-old boy in Fenway Park wind up in New York City or New York area writing about the Mets and baseball as a whole?
Well, the way you described the Rice T-shirt, that's too many words. It was pitchers pay the price when they face Jim Rice. That was the exact wording of it. But, yeah, I mean, I grew up outside in the Boston suburbs as somebody who loved baseball. I loved playing it. I loved the Red Sox. I loved going to games. And let me assure you, even when the Red Sox were decent, it was very easy going to games. I mean, the games weren't always sold out. And if you wanted to go to a game when I was in high school, you just basically you know, headed into town, scalped a couple tickets or bought some bleacher seats for $5 and went to a game. You know, it wasn't the way it is now, where if you want to go to a baseball game, you know, it's going to cost you a couple $100 for a ticket, or it becomes a very expensive night out. That wasn't my experience growing up around baseball at all, by any stretch. But it is strange in the way that a Bostonian like myself or a New Englander like myself wound up coming to New York, and I basically, you know, took it on a shoestring job. I came to work for United Press International after I got out of college. My friend had a job there, and I got a job working 20 hours a week. I knew going to New York was what I needed to do in this business, and they said you can work 20 hours a week, and the hours are 9 to 5. And I said, "Oh, 9 to 5 sounds good." And they said, "Yep, 9 o'clock at night until 5 o'clock in the morning." And what that job was, the building was right across the street from Madison Square Garden. That's where their offices were, and I edited all the game stories that came in from the West Coast. So they came in from the writers, and I formatted them and edited them and did some rewriting and massaged them and then put them out on the wire for newspapers to pick up. Sometimes I wrote stories myself. So I was about to head home after the summer. That was going to be my New York experience until somebody unsolicited recommended me to then New York Newsday, when we had a New York City edition, to cover New York City high schools. So I managed to get that job. Covered a lot of New York City high school basketball, a lot of colleges. And from there, after a few years there, I got probably one of the bigger promotions in the newspaper's history when they promoted me from that job to covering the Yankees, which began in 1995. I had been doing some baseball coverage part-time for them for Newsday because they knew I had some experience doing it for UPI. And that's how basically a Bostonian and Red Sox fan became the Yankees' good luck charm, because as we all know, after a decade or so in the weeds, the Yankees basically became the first American League wild card team ever in 1995, and then went off and won the World Series 4 out of the next 5 years and became a dynasty again. So I take credit for putting the Yankees back on track, I guess.
That's excellent. Pete Alonso. He's a fan.
Don't want to talk more about the Yankees dynasty. The Yankees dynasty years don't interest you very much.
I actually, you know what? David, and just throwing it out there real quick, I'm a converted Mets fan. So I actually was raised on those years, even though I loved the fact as a transplant, really, coming in here when I was 10 years old, I loved the fact that I had two baseball teams as I was falling in love with the game to follow, but then I saw the light and converted in 2005.
David,
fair enough.
As far as I'm concerned, it's funny. In 1973, I was still spending half of my years outside the country. That's why 73 is so spotty for me. Obviously, we're talking about the Mets and the National League pennant. I was in Germany from 86 through 89, 86 through 89. I missed the World Series. I'm still waiting for a Mets World Series. That, and my father was a Yankee fan. I gravitated towards the rivalry. I've been a Red Sox fan since the 70s, and because I missed 86 and 88 and have not witnessed a Mets World Series, the greatest game I've ever been to till this day was Game 5 of the American League Championship Series when Chris Chambliss hit that home run against the Royals. I was on that field in that utter chaos with my father. And it's ponderous that is the most greatest, single most game I've ever been to, and it's not a Met game. Anyway, let us move on, gentlemen. So,
I like the history. The history stuff is great.
It is. I enjoy it. I think it's weird. It's quirky. So, I own it. But Pete Alonso, he's a standalone category because we have the mysterious and controversial Mr. Donnie Stevenson. Mr. Alonso, this is his sophomore season, and he's been one of the more outspoken individuals that have ever come up the pipe. We can rewind this back and start it with, you know, hashtag LFGM. Not too long ago, he made reference to a poop sandwich, if I may. But right now, I think he is in a controversial zone because insofar as analytics, he says he doesn't bring that into the batter's box with him. That's not what he's thinking. It's Pete Alonso versus his opponent, the pitcher, on the mound. And he's not thinking percentage and this, that, or the other. That, and in response to Chili Davis's firing, he pretty much very flatly said it doesn't make sense to him. So his outspokenness is in conflict with, I think, the organizational philosophy, or at least his words are. And is outspokenness going to catch up with him?
I don't. I mean, I'll start off by saying that I'm not unabashed in saying this, is that I kind of love everything that's going on with Pete Alonso. I think from the moment he showed up, he's just really been everything a franchise could want. I mean, not only is he an incredibly talented player and a very extremely hardworking player, he's got a great personality. I mean, the character, he's great for the media, for us. He's always been extremely accommodating. He's not boring in things that he says. He has great insight. He's legitimately funny. He doesn't just crack corny jokes. I think he said some legitimately funny stuff. He busts up his teammates. Who doesn't love a big slugger? You know, he even has a colorful nickname with the polar bear, which he's really played up to. When he was there at the All-Star game and won the home run derby, I had a blast being there covering him during that time. I really, and I don't say this about very many players at all, I love everything about covering the guy. He's incredibly fun to watch. I like talking to him. He's got a great personality. I think the Mets are lucky to have him. That said, I think the one thing he missed the boat on, and I'm only guessing that Donnie Stevenson was his creation. And like I mentioned to him in the press conference the other day, I can understand that it probably originated as a lighthearted thing, as a funny thing to kind of get the guys going. Maybe it was kind of poking fun at the media because, you know, they didn't like after answering questions about why weren't they hitting or this, so this was kind of a way to get around that. I think if maybe they had a chance to think about it, and I just think that wasn't a very good thing. I mean, you have a hitting coach, his name's Chili Davis, and to go on ESPN – and to credit somebody, a fictional person called Donnie Stevenson, you know, as giving you guys the approach or giving you something, figuring out a way to get out of your hitting slump, and then having a carry-on with Conforto on the Zooms and Brandon Nimmo on the Zooms. I just thought it was disrespectful to Chili Davis. I know Chili had talked to the New York Post and said he wants the guys to have fun, but he did say, quote, "It probably didn't help." And I think that's pretty honest. I think behind the scenes, he's probably more honest than that. Because when players do well, guys, what do you hear? The first thing they do is they credit their real coaches. You know, Chili Davis was, you know, spent extra hours in the cage with me, or me and Chili were watching video and we found this, or Chili saw something in my at-bats last night that he pointed out and it helped me do this. That happens all the time. But then when you have the podium or the microphone, you know, you make up somebody and give that person credit rather than Chili. I just think if those guys were given more time to think about it, they would have probably thought it was a bad idea. And, you know, Louis Rojas was asked about it, and Louis said that was just guys having fun. Well, I pose this to Louis then. What if the team went on a winning streak and they had won 8 of 9 or 11 of 15, and somebody said, "Hey, you know, what's going on with you guys? You've really pulled it together. You've really tightened up the defense. You're hitting great. Everybody's pitching well. and somebody on the team said, like Jacob DeGrom or whoever you want, Pete Alonso said, yeah, you know, we have this manager called Donnie Stevenson who's really been inspiring us, you know, really been pushing us behind the scenes with a lot of inspirational clubhouse meetings and making some great decisions during the game. I mean, Donnie Stevenson really has a magical touch with the lineup card, always makes the right decisions when you bring in the relief pitchers. Yeah, Donnie Stevenson has been the guy. How do you think Louis Rojas would feel about that? You think he would think it was a funny joke that guys were having fun with? So I just don't think people were looking at this logically. You know, like I said, I love covering Pete Alonso. I think he's what baseball needs. They should have 500 of them. And this one, guys, I think he missed the boat on this one.
Sam, you know, again, I'm playing the role of contrarian, but you and I spoke earlier today, and Pete Alonso did bring foul language into the conversation. That, and I was listening to part of the game this afternoon, Wayne Randazzo said that Pete Alonso was wearing a T-shirt with the Donnie character on it, even today. So take it away, Sam.
Well, apparently he's selling one pretty quickly on his website. So, you know, let's look to that. but, I, you know, in terms of the firing, too, I just want to loop back to what you guys were talking about with Louis Rojas, because I watched his rain-out press conference, and it was very gloomy. It was very, like when they were asking him, do you think this team needs a day anyway? And then they lost the first game. But, you know, it's nice that they've won the first two, the last two. But you could still see it in his face then that something was amiss. Something was, awry. And I remember he was wearing a hoodie, too. And he wasn't wearing the uniform. He was just wearing the hoodie. And something just seemed off about his demeanor. And tying this into the whole Donnie Stevenson thing, you know, I think that, you know, maybe they're thinking about it now. But in the moment, you know, you don't want to, like, consider that. You can't think about the fact that they made this decision, but then somebody presents you with that question, and I can understand right in the moment where they're just going to need some breathing room, maybe coming to terms over the course of their lives and the season with this. But it just matters. The W's are all that matters here, you know. And it was quite fun because, you know, we were talking about Sid Finch and Donnie Stevenson, and they were, you know, pitching coaches, Sid Finch and Donnie Stevenson's the hitting coach. Like, all of a sudden there are two made-up characters in Mets history. It was kind of fun at first, but, like, you know, I remember somebody at the beginning of the Cardinals series, and it didn't exactly happen this way, but they said, I don't want to hear one more word about Donnie Stevenson if they get swept by the Cardinals. So the W is all that matters. And again, I point to the LOB. That's the number one thing this team needs to fix, and that's the number one thing this franchise needs to fix. And until you fix that, you're not going to win many ball games, and you're not going to win many playoff series, let alone a championship.
LOB, the LOB machine. We're going to get in-depth in pitching, hitting, and defense. But first, Rich, Pete Alonso, and then I defer the microphone to you. Let's open up your question to Mr. Lennon.
Pete Alonso, it's intent and impact. You know, we say that in business all the time, you know. My intent was this. Okay, yeah, I get that. But the impact was this. Do you see that? And I think that's where Pete is with it. And I think I'm sure his intent clearly was to create something funny. And let's face it, they were not hitting. They were playing horrible baseball. That Friday night in Philadelphia was one of the worst performances I've ever seen from the Mets, you know, with the two runs scoring on the wild pitch with the bases loaded, or I'm not sure it was a pass ball. I think it was actually a pass ball. So things were rough. You know, he tried to break the mood by doing something funny. And to many, it was funny. To me, it was funny. But then the impact, then you start to see the impact. Chili Davis is a human being. This, you know, and you are kind of, by saying it was this fictitious person who got us going, that the impact, when you pull back and look at it, was pretty bad. You know, it really was. You know, and it's, and I'm sure they didn't mean that to happen. But look, I've been there, you know, where I've done things and my intent was one thing and the impact was another. And when you pull back and see that, you feel pretty badly. And I think that's probably what happened to Pete there. And I think we've all said the same thing. There was no bad, there was no ill intent there. It was just the impact that had happened. So, but, you know, getting to my question for David, actually I have two, if I may.
Yeah.
Popped in my head, and I have one that I had submitted earlier. So the one that's spontaneous, though, is this one. Jack Welch, former, you know, businessman, everybody knows who Jack Welch is. He's famous for saying that strategy eats – I'm sorry, I said backwards. Culture eats strategy for lunch. And here's my question to you. You're around the team. I know it's mostly Zoom now. But you're around the team, and I worry about the culture on the team that Luis Rojas has created. So, and I want to, my question to you is, how do you see that? Because the Mets strategy might be right. You know, we all hear the rumors that the front office creates the lineup based on analytics and all that. So strategy is in place. Fine strategy, no problem strategy. What about culture? And here's what I mean. It's been 86 games under Rojas. I have yet to see this team look inspired. As I see it, the manager has a huge role in setting culture. Think about late 2019 under Mickey Callaway. You know, those guys, the Cookie Club and all this stuff was going on, and they were jumping all over the place and that kind of thing, and you just heard them. They sounded different to me. They looked different. It looked like they approached their jobs differently. And so that's my question is, look, I'm a fan, right? I'm not around the team like you are. What can you say about culture? Do you think the culture is good on this team? You think it's basically the same and it just looks bad because they're not hitting with runners in scoring position? What can you say about that?
Well, I think you pointed to, and you mentioned it early in your question about this, that what's really hurt us, the media, and by proxy the fans, is not being in the clubhouse. I mean, we've now been out of the clubhouse almost a full year. Actually, it's been more than a year, because if you count back of spring training from last year, and that's where I could really tell you what the culture of this team is like, because I would see them before games. I would see them after games. I would talk to them in private settings. I would be able to get the pulse on what was happening, what people thought of what was happening, who was doing a good job, who wasn't. And we can't do that now. We really can't. I mean, now we're relying on phone calls with people. A lot of times that's going to be maybe executives on what's going on with the team. Otherwise, it's going to be stuff that's on Zoom, which is public. So, you know, I hate to say it, but I really can't tell you with any type of certainty what the culture of this team is like, because I haven't seen it in so long. I mean, now, and I'm sure that any other beat writer or columnist would say the same thing. I mean, I know the character of some of these guys because I've known they've been around the team for a while since the clubhouses have been open or since they've been shut. And I can tell you that as far as what I know about the people on the roster, they're all solid, good guys, good competitive guys, good working guys. So from that sense, yeah, I mean, I think they have the capacity of being a good crew in that regard, especially when you have good leaders on the team like a DeGrom heading the rotation. That's important. I think when you've added somebody like Trevor Maid in the bullpen, I think he brings something to the table as far as the presence goes too. I like James McCann from what I've learned about him since he's joined the team. But it's really hard to get a finger on the pulse without being in those behind-the-scenes setting. And I think you mentioned under Callaway in the second half of 2019, where that was a team that was really together, that team found something. And I think a lot of the culture and chemistry that you're talking about, of course, comes from winning. It's kind of a chicken-and-egg type of thing. you'll find a lot more chemistry and culture on teams that are winning than you do on losing teams. That's not a coincidence. I think the pieces are in place on this team is that you can have a winning culture with the roster that they have. They haven't shown it so far. I'm not sure how much to attribute that to Luis Rojas. He's not a particularly high-energy guy, it seems like, not even when you see him in the games. But I think the reason for that, again, is that he's still kind of new at the job. And I think that that's not something that comes natural to him. And maybe that just doesn't work with the roster they have in place right now. Not that I thought that Mickey Callaway was a good manager by any stretch of the imagination. But for some reason during that time, these personalities clicked and put together a good run that September. And we haven't really seen that spark. You're right. That observation, I think anybody would say that now, just looking at the team from the outside, there does seem to be something missing there.
There really does seem to be something missing, and it seems palpable. And thank you for your comments. And then my second question for you is completely unrelated to what we've been talking about. The collective bargaining agreement between the Players Association and MLB. I love the game, obviously, as we all do, and I was very worried, I still am, about 2022, because when you think about the gulf that's between these two teams and the acrimony that's been going back and forth, you know, for those of us who go back this far, it seems like, you know, the kind of stuff that happened in the 80s, the 81 strike, and you know, then again in 94. So I'm very concerned about next season. I've been thinking about it a lot, and I know I should be worrying about this season, then next season, but that's not the way my brain works. So when I heard that they met, the two sides met, no one knew they were meeting, but then it came out, oh, they met, one meeting, okay, fine. I took that as a positive. So my question for you, David, is this. I mean, your industry buzz, like what you're hearing, do you think that there's a chance that they see the fact that, look, if we shut this game down, it's really going to be bad. In a pandemic or coming out of a pandemic, people are not going to go for this, and we're really going to kill ourselves. So do you think there's a chance that they get that and that they could work together and maybe we could do this thing without having a stoppage in 2022 that until I heard they were meeting, I was convinced there was going to be a stoppage. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, pre-pandemic, it was a question that came up quite a bit just because of the growing acrimony between the two sides. And pre-pandemic, I always said, no, there won't be a work stoppage. Nobody is that stupid to shut down the league with the money that's being made, the money in TV contracts, the money the players are making, and this type of environment. I just think that's just lunacy to even consider any type of work stoppage. Then the pandemic came along, and we saw on display for months. You know, I covered those labor negotiations on a daily basis, and the mistrust and the deception was off the charts, and it just kept going. You know, I had wondered if they were ever going to come to agreement on playing that season out. I was very skeptical. They eventually did when they settled on 60 games, but people agreed they could have played much more than that. They should have come to an agreement much earlier than that, but the owners thought they would lose more money that way. So the situation we're in now, you know, you mentioned that meeting that was brought up. I think there's a lot of other behind-the-scenes meetings that you don't hear about. That one became public because somebody wanted it to become public. There's other ones that you won't hear anything about that they talk. They talk more often than you might think. There's real issues there, and that mistrust still remains. I am still skeptical there'll be a work stoppage. I mean, if I had to bet on it, I would say there won't be. I'm not sure how many of the big issues they're going to figure out by the time they hit that deadline in December. But I think the financial issues are so complex. They're so entrenched about going the route of the other leagues, of the hard salary cap and the restrictions on spending, that it wouldn't surprise me if they just decide to punt on it and continue the same system in place just because people are going to realize, you know, like democracy, it's the worst of a lot of bad options. I think that's a description of it. It's the worst of a lot of bad choices for government. What they have in place now, I should say, is democracy is the best of a lot of bad choices. But and I shouldn't say the worst. I think that the political season got the best of me. I'm still a little stuck on that. But they, but I think both sides would look at it and say, hey, what we have in place right now isn't perfect. We both hate a lot of aspects of it, but it might be as good as we can get it in order to keep this sport playing. I mean, I could be wrong, but I think from what I've heard on it, I really feel like that's what they're going to have to do. Maybe there'll be some slight tweaking to it. You know, maybe there'll be something touched up with the arbitration. Maybe they'll figure out a way to get players more guaranteed money earlier. But I think as far as the system in place, it's going to be hard. With the strength of the union and the way things are, it's going to be tough to really blow things up like other leagues have and gone to so much restrictions on salary. I think baseball is going to have to try to find a way. Though both sides want big changes, I feel like they're going to find a way to continue to at least get a new CBA in place and maybe work on those things moving forward. The short answer to answer your question, I do think there will be a season next year. I don't think there'll be a work stoppage.
Great to hear. Thank you.
Yep.
Sam, the floor is yours.
Well, I'm going to be a little slightly spontaneous, but having to do with what we just talked about before I get to my main thing. David, do you think that basically the 2020 season was the work stoppage, the fact that they weren't able to get games, as many games as most people thought they should, was basically like getting some of the worms out basically early, and now that's one of the reasons why you're not as skeptical?
I don't know if I would qualify it because of that. I see what you're saying. It's like did both sides get to like peek into the abyss and see what a work stoppage might be like, and they smartly pulled themselves back and were able to cobble together enough of a working agreement. I now that you mention it, I can see some value in that, you know, that they saw how dark things can get and how bad things can get and how, you know, how entrenched we can get, and maybe we shouldn't push ourselves to that point again. I think that could be in the back of their minds. That said, you know, you get into wartime, you know, you lose sight of what's important, or you lose sight of what your best interest might be. You become so determined on winning that you don't care that you're going scorched earth policy and just trashing everything just because you're not getting your way. I think there's still an element of that that exists, and I think there is still part of it on both sides, you know, that would be fine going to war over this. But I think when they step back and look at the financial stakes, and listen, guys, even with the TV deals that are being signed, like Lindor getting $340 million contracts, you know, baseball does have some fixing to do to figure out where it's going to be in the entertainment landscape going forward. I mean, anybody that has kids, I don't. I have nieces and nephews. But I see what the younger generation is like and what holds their interest. And I think baseball's having a harder time with that. And I see why. I mean, it's a much faster paced, you know, social entertainment landscape now. It's much more immediate. You know, I love to see baseball games that go 2.5 hours, that are brisk and the action moves along. I think that helps the sport. I think that's how the sport should be played when it's at its best. We've lost sight of that over time. But I would hope that the two sides realize that baseball, in many ways, and people would say that it really isn't the national pastime anymore. And a work stoppage and further damage to the game could hurt that much, much more.
I completely agree. And I want to go a little back to considering that it's Willie Mays' birthday. Howie Rose was talking today about, he was asking the fans basically to chime in since there's a backlog of numbers that need to be retired, and he's on a committee looking into that, what we thought about Willie Mays. And I said that, you know, considering what he meant to New York and what he meant to the matriarch of this team, Joan Payson, that I think that even though they probably should have done it right after she died, it didn't happen, but I still think that it would be important, especially while Willie Mays is alive. So what is your take on not only Willie Mays, but all of Mets' retired numbers, as it seems like the purse strings are being loosened, theoretically, when it comes to the new ownership and retiring Mets numbers?
Yeah, that's – I like the Mays idea, I do. I mean, I think that's that would be a great gesture, especially when you're having somebody of the stature of Willie Mays. You know, that's not somebody that's a once in a generational, or I should say once in a multi-generational ball player. So that is a guy that I can see where Howie is coming from on that. Knowing Mets fans and being a part of these discussions with the retired numbers, there's a big segment of Mets fans who like the exclusivity, you know, that there's only a handful of numbers that have been retired, as opposed to a lot of other teams where you have 10, 11, 12 guys getting their numbers retired or being in rings of honors. So I think they would wonder that once you start retiring numbers, is it going to start to be too many? Everybody has their favorite players. You know, they'd love to see their numbers retired. You know, I guess, you know, if you're having knowledgeable people who are putting in good input and there's good decisions behind getting those numbers retired, then yeah, you know, I think it does make sense to do that because it's more people to talk about. It's more of a presence at the stadium when you have those numbers to look up at. I think that's part of the experience of being a fan of the team. So I do see that. I know fans go back and forth on how many people they want to have retired or how much they want to expand that. I think they're really torn about it. So I'd be interested to see where the discussion goes and you know, what happens with it, because I know it's going to be a pretty spirited debate once it does.
Well, I'll get a little bit of that debate started. I mean, I think, for one thing, I think it's asinine to not cover every single era, especially the championship eras, and even outside of the championship eras. Luckily, we've covered Piazza, but maybe I could even say that some other numbers from that era should be retired, but I think that's a whole other conversation for a whole other day. I just also, first of all, David, thank you again for joining us. I just wanted to talk today about today's game. I thought it was just interesting. I thought it was a very important game to win. And I thought it was interesting the way the narrative went from another loss at the hands of a great pitching performance without getting any runners in to just the narrative being how good Taijuan Walker was, probably the second best performance of the year for the New York Mets, I would say. And then it was, you know, Edwin Diaz struggled again, especially after Philadelphia, but he seemed to come through. And I thought today was a really important game, especially once they were gifted the lead. And I thought from a narrative perspective, it was interesting the way the game shifted. And I really appreciated it, of course.
No, I mean, well, right. I mean, like you said before, I mean, a win is a win. I mean, that's the bottom line. Walker was great. I think Walker is turning out to be the free agent pitcher signing of the offseason. I mean, it was really a brilliant move by the Mets and holding off and getting him on such a great deal. I mean, he's been fantastic. I mean, what has there been? Maybe one start of his to throw out? Otherwise, he's been solid. And that's been really good because you're talking about a team that's still waiting for Carrasco and Noah Syndergaard to return. I mean, those are two tremendous pieces. We'll see how Syndergaard feels coming back from Tommy John, obviously. Usually that takes a little time to kind of get back, to truly get back up to speed again. But Walker has been quite a find. I mean, that's been a great get for them from this winter. He showed it again today. And as far as offensively, yeah, I mean, like we've the theme here with the left on base, I think it was 17 today, right? I mean, with some, it was a ridiculous number. Hey, part of this game and part of winning this game is taking what the other team gives you and not squandering it, and give the Mets credit for doing that today. Whether it's bases loaded walks, whether it's capitalizing on errors, whether it's mistake pitches, whatever. You know, they took what the Cardinals gave them today and didn't blow it. They haven't done that enough this year. The Phillies gave them a couple extra chances during that series as well. So, hey, you take the split, you come home and try to build on that. But, yeah, I mean, it wasn't one of those games that you're going to hang on your mantle as one of the turning points of the season, but they'll take it, especially to end a road trip on.
Exactly. Thank you again, David. And go ahead, Mike.
Gentlemen, let's crunch some numbers. Pitching, hitting, and defense. The Mets are a 500 team, 13-13. There's good, there's bad, there's ugly. I will say they're trending upwards. They're 4-3 on the road trip. Loss, win, win. St. Louis, loss, loss, win, win. Let's do hitting first because I think this is going to be the most fun. Today's game, 17 runners left on base, a club record for a 9-inning game. Incredible. Digest this, if you will. New York Mets, runs scored, last. Hits, last. Home runs, last. Total bases, last. Walks, second to last. Today, they stole their fourth base of the season. Stolen bases, last. Now, upward trends. Team average is up. They are fifth. Slugging is ticking upwards. They are now 13th. OPS is upticking. They are now 10th. Rich, once upon a time in 1983, Darryl Strawberry broke into the bigs, and he was 2-for-20. And what do you recall fans in the media doing? They compared him to Willie Mays. Happy birthday. In 1951, he started the season 1-for-27. Francisco Lindor, at one point in today's game, was 0-for-26. Came into this at-bat 0-for-26. And then finally broke this, you know, snapped that string. Finally got hit. He is now 1-for-27 or 1-for-28, something to that effect. I said last week he deserved the benefit of the doubt. But I threw out all those offensive numbers. You do with it what you will. Pick it up. Hitting. Rich.
Well, and I think we know that on Willie Mays' birthday was the day Darryl Strawberry made his debut, which, you know, was a big deal at the time. And obviously it was all over social media today. But, you know, in terms of the numbers you're talking about, Michael, you know, let's talk specifically about Lindor. Everybody knows, you know, this young man is going to be just fine. It's taking a painfully long time. And the stuff that you see with him, you know, that Keith points out, it's not like he's hitting in hard luck, you know, making hard contact. The ball just won't fall. This is a guy who is temporarily lost. You know, you could see it. The butt flies out, you know, like Keith always says, the fanny exits, and then you've got nothing but hands and arms to hit the ball, and you're not generating any power that way. You're not driving the ball. So he's broken at the moment. He'll be repaired. You know, he'll repair himself. I thought his at-bat in the third inning today was the best sign, much better sign than the base hit he got. He hit that ball really hard in the third inning when there were men on base. It was a line out to, you know, fairly deep center field. He was on top of that pitch. He'll be fine. You know, when you look at the rest of the numbers, I do believe they'll correct themselves. You know, call me an optimist, but I think you'll see these things start to happen. And Conforto looked good in Philadelphia. He didn't look particularly good in this series. And so, you know, he's still a little bit up and down. Pete has held it pretty well. You know, he obviously will drive a lot of the OPS, and the slugging numbers will be a big contributor to that. They're playing without J.D. Davis, who contributes to the power numbers, so we have to take that into consideration. McCann has been, I'm interested in David's comments on this, McCann has been, and I like the guy, and I think he's a great defensive catcher, but offensively, I mean, my goodness, he's, oof. You know, you're expecting a little more there, and you're sure he'll come around. So what I'm saying is they have pretty big gaps in people who are good hitters, like Conforto, like Lindor. You know, and J.D. Davis is out, so you're playing without him. So although Pilar has, you know, been playing lately, and Pilar's been, you know, actually quite good over the past week, so it'll correct itself. I think a lot of it revolves around those couple of players who are big contributors and who are just not contributing right now. So that's what I think it is. I think that they will, to use a cliche, live up to the back of their baseball cards, and then the team numbers will rise accordingly. That's my take on it right now.
So, Mr. Lennon, hitting is an open-ended question, but like Rich said about James McCann, me personally, I believe the onus is on Conforto, Lindor, Alonso, McNeil, and others. McCann, I'm more interested in the receiver than I am the hitter. So I have no issue, and I think he's getting a lot of heat on Mets Twitter for it.
I was just gonna say, based on what you said earlier, are you saying the Mets just gave the 1973 Willie Mays $340 million? Was that what you were suggesting with that season-opening streak there? Because that would not be a good investment, with all respect to Willie Mays. But no, I mean I agree with Lindor. I mean, Lindor is going to come around and eventually be Francisco Lindor. But I don't care who you talk to about it. I mean, you don't have to be a scout or some baseball expert to look at his at bats, you know, to this point, and just look at how lost he had been at the plate. I mean, it just didn't even really have any confidence. I mean, he was down in the count constantly. He has worked, you know, a number of walks. I will say, in many of those cases, and in Philly against Alvarado specifically, who didn't throw the ball within 2 feet of the strike zone, kind of bailed him out that night. But you have to expect Lindor to come around, because what's the other choice? You know, that you just signed a 165 hitter to a $300 million contract. So, yeah, you have to think that he's going to wind up coming around. And, you know, I mentioned McCann and guys like Dom, too. You know, when I was talking about the hitting coach switch with some people in the organization, you know, those are guys that had them worried. You know, they really thought that those regressions, they had to do something. You know, they had to switch something on the hitting end. You know, whether it be the coaches, in this case, to help those guys, to get them on track. For whatever reason, they are where they are right now, and there needed to be some better machinery in place to get those guys fixed. So, you know, it's been, what are we at, 27 games in or something to this point now, 28 games in. You know, it's not nothing. You know, you're starting to get into one-sixth of the season now. So it's becoming more than just a small sample size, but you still have to assume that these guys are going to perform like their track records say they should, and I don't really think it gets more complicated than that. I mean, I don't think it's a case where you have to go up and down the lineup and start fixing people. You know, I think that there's some track record there that these guys can do what they've done in the past, and that's how this team was put together. And if they can't do that, I saw people wondering if Tomas Nito should be getting some more playing time. That's pretty rough to say, considering you just gave McCann $40 million. So, you know, they have to start getting better. We'll check back at Memorial Day. We'll see how they're doing at the All-Star break. But you'd have to assume that these things are going to start to get better for them.
Sam, you've been grinding your teeth all season so far about left on base. Today was a club record. You know, but today they, you know, provided just enough offense to get by. Poor defense, good pitching. But it was what it was, wasn't it?
You know, even though they followed up the last run that they scored with a bunch of LOB, they still, at least the last thing that happened was a hit. Dominic Smith got a hit. The other runs were three runs on walks. I mean, you have to give credit where credit is due for holding on to this, considering the way the book usually goes is that if the Mets offense is going to only get that many runs because of walks, you know, the bullpen will eventually give it up. That's just what's going to happen. And it was, you know, pleasantly surprising to see Edwin Diaz trend the other way, even though after being extremely dominant over the first few games, he looked extremely not dominant against the Phillies. And then it looked like today we're starting to see, you know, Edwin Diaz be the Edwin Diaz that we fear he could be. But, you know, like, basically, like, the only time I've ever had any faith in any closer on the New York Mets was Yuris Familia in 2015, until the two quick pitches in a row in the World Series. Until the World Series. It's the only time, and even in 2016, when he got like 50 saves in a row, he was a lot more shaky. He was much more what we were used to as, you know, Mets closers. But, you know, what you want, of course, is what you've seen from Edwin Diaz at the beginning of this year is just such utter, nasty, dominant stuff where nobody can catch up to him, because not only is the fastball fast, but it has unbelievable movement that you've never seen out of a pitcher. But sometimes something goes awry, and luckily today he was able to induce a ground ball and they were able to get the force out. And that's all you care about. And as long as he can figure that out and not give up the big bomb, which has been basically his Achilles heel, has been that big bomb. Especially, you know, today the tying run was up, and especially considering that he's always literally like a pitch before he gives up the big bomb is the nastiest pitch you've ever seen. Something's got to give, and he's got to start maturing. And hopefully a game like today was us seeing Edwin Diaz, Mr. Sugar, mature.
He's a podcast unto himself. You know, it was a questionable move bringing him into the Philly game. He bounced back today, but we learned back in Philly he was pitching with discomfort. Mr. Lennon, we have Diaz's discomfort, as I just mentioned, a DeGrom. He has tightness. You need to put that through the translator for us. We got a disposition on Carlos Carrasco, and we're still waiting on Seth Lugo. I will just mention a nice bounce back effort by David Peterson. And lastly, I will say, as you noted, Taijuan Walker is just cruising along. What an outstanding performance today. At one point, he retired 17 straight batters. That ties a career high, 8 strikeouts. Wonderful performance. Joey Lucchesi, not so much. He's not even pitching to his baseball card. Jordan Yamamoto, that remains to be seen. The point being, this is what the Mets had in mind. Young pitchers, live arms with minor league options. And here we are, Yamamoto. You know, again, his performance is yet to be determined. So summarize pitching for us, please, Mr. Lennon.
Well, I mean, the case of DeGrom and Carrasco, you know, they clearly have nothing to worry about because the Mets' track record with injuries has been flawless. So, you know, you can really rest easy. Then none of those are going to develop. You know, the chances of those developing into serious problems are zero, you know, based on what we've learned from watching the Mets all these years. But, you know, kidding aside, I mean, I certainly hope DeGrom is fine. I mean, he's a marvel to watch, and, you know, he's a key to everything the Mets do or hope to do. So hopefully, knock on wood, that he is healthy. And I don't know if I really agree with bringing him back on Sunday. I'm not sure that's the best idea. As much as he wants to come back, and how supposedly Grady's feeling. You know, inflammation in the side of a lat, inflammation is not the problem. Inflammation is the sign that something else is wrong. And that's why you're getting the inflammation. So I don't think it would have been the worst idea to put him on the IL, let him sit there for a bit, really get himself ready and good to go. I didn't really think there was a need to rush him back. Hopefully he's fine. But pitching-wise, like I mentioned before, I mean, they're expected to get Carrasco and Syndergaard back at some point, and that would be great for them. Stroman, who I considered a wild card coming into this year based on his the ceiling of his ability, but the fact that he was coming off a year without pitching, he's looked good. You know, he's really had some standout situations. He's striking out more people than I even thought he might. You know, we know he's a ground ball specialist, gets a lot of balls in play, puts a lot of balls on the ground. So that's something they pitched out of a jam the other night. So I think Stroman has been a good contributor for them. But yeah, Lucchese has been a disappointment. I'm not sure what he's going to pan out to be for them. Peterson, you know, we saw good things out of him last year. I had big expectations for him. And again, his ceiling looks like it can be pretty high, that he can be a quality starter for them. I mean, I think if you throw out that start he had in Philly in his first start of the year, you know, he's pitched pretty well. So I think rotation-wise, they're going to be in pretty decent shape. I mean, the pitching numbers have been backing that up. Walker's been a big key to that, obviously. So like we've said in the past with the Mets, except for, you know, when they were bringing guys like Walker in here to fill in the gaps, you know, this has been a team that when it's done well, it succeeded with their pitching staff. And I think that's going to be the case again this year.
Rich, the Mets are a 500 team because of their pitching. They're being carried by their pitching. As we're going to discuss in defense, right now pitching is the only thing they have going for themselves. But Joey Lucchese, last word, is still scheduled to make his next start. As we say, he's struggling, but, you know, pitching, the floor is open.
Well, I think you're right, Mike. I think you could look at the 500 start in two ways. You could say, well, you know, they're clearly not firing on all cylinders. In fact, you can make the argument that it's basically a six-cylinder car firing on two or three, and they're able to be 500 and still in the race. And what the cylinders that are firing right now are the pitching ones, right? You look at it, DeGrom, of course, is DeGrom, and there's not much more to say there. Stroman, I agree, has been a very pleasant surprise. We all knew he had talent, but he's been just outstanding. Peterson, you know, saved for that one bad start in Philadelphia, like we talked about. Peterson's been very good. But the rotation, you know, does have an underbelly, and that underbelly right now is Lucchese. He's been bad, and he's been really bad. There's no other way to soft sell that. I mean, the guy just hasn't been good. So what this tells us is, you know, the starting pitching in general, Taijuan Walker, what a steal that was. I mean, this guy was still out there in February, right before spring training. And how great has he been? So, but again, the good news is how you want to look at it. You could say they have a real weakness at the fifth spot of the rotation. Yes, they do, with Lucchese right now. Or you could say, well, you know, you have to tread water for another month, and then you'll hopefully have Carrasco. You're hearing a lot of mixed stories on that. Hopefully you'll have Carrasco back, and then maybe about 6 weeks from now have Syndergaard back, and now you have a quote-unquote glut of starting pitching, which is really no such thing, but that'll really go a long way too. So the pitching has held it together. The bullpen, what about that bullpen? The bullpen's been fantastic. You look at these guys, like Trevor May had that one bad outing until I think it was opening night, but this guy's been good. This guy's lived up to his billing, you know, and oftentimes that doesn't happen. So you have that. Loop has generally been good. You know, Gesellman, I mean, everybody was screaming, like, how could Gesellman have a job? How does Yamamoto go down at the beginning of the season and Gesellman have a job? And Gesellman's been very good. So the starting pitching, I think most teams would take 4 out of 5 starters doing well, happily so, very happy to have that. The bullpen is exceeding expectations at this point. And what I'll say is, and thank God for that, because we all know about the offensive woes. That pitching staff has kept this team 500, kept them afloat and kept them in the conversation. So thank goodness for this pitching staff.
Sam?
First of all, I just can't wait for Noah Syndergaard to come back and be the personal hitting coach for Taijuan Walker, because this guy looks like if he were focusing on hitting, he would crush it. And he got his first hit as a New York Met today, so I look forward to that and him adding to this elite pitching offense that the Mets have. But I digress with specifically what we actually pay these guys for, which is to put bullets into the strike zone past the bats. And Taijuan Walker today looked like an absolute monster. Imagine if you can get DeGrom, Stroman, and Walker in a row doing that, what they did today. That was just some brilliant stuff. The pitching has been phenomenal. Hopefully Noah Syndergaard and Carlos Carrasco can segue in. Obviously, Lucchesi has been, you know, and you wonder, especially considering that it was kind of a controversial foul tip that led to him really giving that game up. And I really still, you know, Mike, you and I were talking about Johnny Damon against the Phillies in 2009 and how before he stole second and third, it didn't look like he made contact on a ball that was called a foul tip. I don't know how you can correct moments like that. That's a tough one to talk about when it comes to replay and when it comes to robotic umpires and all this type of stuff that we're talking about with this game and what is going to happen over the future of this game. But, you know, like, it's very interesting because we could be talking a totally different narrative had they held that lead, that 5-2 lead, and, you know, Arenado ended up tying it on that foul ball. So it's weird, you know. You want these guys to do well, but right now you are seeing that one way or another, the Mets could use one more great starting pitcher, regardless of how good what we're talking about. But both the bullpen, like Rich mentioned, as well as the starting pitching, have kept them in the conversation, the Mets in the conversation. So, but Lucchesi has not been able to just segue right into that. And it looked like he may be able to kind of bounce back, and it just wasn't able to happen on that one specific at bat.
We'll see. Maybe he can straighten himself out at Syracuse. Last one. I'm going to throw another little batch of stats out there. Stats are like law. It's all a matter of interpretation. All right, dig this, guys. Today there were two more errors in the field. That brings the grand total up to 18. Places the Mets roughly ninth in the National League. They have the third worst fielding percentage. All right, now, the Mets have the fewest total chances. The Mets have the fewest assists, and the Mets have the fewest putouts. Some of that is attributable to pitching, and some of that is attributable to playing about five or six less games in the competition. However, being the team with the fewest in those categories makes those 18 errors stick out that much more. And here's the cherry on top, and this is another one I got from Wayne Randazzo listening today. The Mets have allowed 22 unearned runs. That's the most in the National League. Defense. Rich, I'll start with you again.
Well, if you think about defense, you think about the defense on this team, you have to look at, like, the root cause, right? Yes, we know they're not a good defensive team. And cause analysis is not terribly difficult to do. You know, they have – Mike, you and I have talked about this on this podcast for years. They have way too many guys playing out of position. Now, Dom Smith playing left field has not actually been bad. You know, he really hasn't been that bad. But, again, he's a first baseman playing left field. Let's not lose sight of that. So while he generally makes the plays on balls he gets to, you know, there are a lot of balls he's not getting to. So you have that. And then J.D. Davis is a DH in the National League, which maybe the National League will have DH next year, but this year we don't in the National League. So, and I'm not trying to come down on the guy because he had a really bad game in Chicago, but let's face it, he's pretty well known to not be a good defender. So you're going into this. In summary, my point is this. This is not a surprise. This is the way the roster was constructed, and it was like, you know, Sandy said it in that spring training game that was on ESPN. He said, we don't have defensive geniuses out there. Okay, so when that stuff comes home to roost and it costs you ball games, what are you going to do? I mean, are you going to come down on these guys? This is the way this team was put together. Sandy Alderson, we all know, is a guy who kind of minimizes the need for defense in baseball. You know, I've read his book, and he basically says it in the book. I saw some quotes from him after the 2017 season where he agreed that, you know what, maybe I do need to change my thinking a little bit. You know, the defense maybe does matter more than I've appreciated. Fast forward that 4 years, look at the team he's putting on the field. You know, this poor defensive team isn't the result of injuries. It's not the result defenders just, you know, clanking some balls, which is going to happen, human error. This is a team that they basically said, okay, we'll go in with a bad defensive team. And you know what, Sandy? You have a bad defensive team. And it's frustrating to me as a fan because I like the basics. I'm like Keith. I like the fundies. And I'll leave it at this. I've said from the beginning of the season, from spring training, that there are two things that I think could take the team down this year. Number one is the defense. Number two is Rojas. And, you know, right now I'm not happy to basically be right at this point. But I think that when the philosophy is that it's okay to sacrifice defense, then I think you're going to live with it, and you just have to hope that it doesn't cost you too many games. I think that's where we are.
David, 22 unearned runs in 26 games played is just bad math.
That's pretty ugly. I mean, I just think that, you know, in Sandy's case and the way these teams are put together, they just fall in love with the offensive end. And defense is always the thing that gets squeezed out. You know, everybody, you know, he's putting together these teams. Let's get all these great pitchers in here. We develop some good pitchers. Let's get more pitching in. Let's get more starting pitching in. Let's get more bullpen in. All right, what do we need offensively? Do we need another home run hitter? Do we need somebody that hits for more average? Do we need contact hitters? Do we need guys to strike out less? Let's figure out what we're going to do to stretch out the lineup, make it deeper, make it more relentless, make it so, you know, people can't handle it. Then by the time they have all those discussions, it's like they just have no more energy left to even worry about the defense. Or they're just like, oh, yeah, they got to put gloves on too and go on the other side. It just gets, like, forgotten. You know, you just wonder why more teams in general aren't built on the defense. You know, I think part of that with the Mets to some degree, you know, if you have pitchers at the top of the rotation like DeGrom and Syndergaard, who are just going to strike everybody out anyway, they're just like, eh, so we'll have a couple ground balls here and there, maybe a couple fly balls. You know, we'll figure out a way to get those outs. So we have all these guys that aren't going to pitch the contact anyway. You know, so what difference does it make? Stroman's a different case, clearly. But, you know, I think that's just kind of the thinking they got caught up in. But then you see the kind of the plays where defense matters. We see Almora made that great catch to save that game a week ago. You know, this must have saved two runs with that grab leaping into the wall, which is a catch that Nimmo doesn't make. He just doesn't. He doesn't go on a full sprint and track down the ball like that. Or if he does, he crashes into the wall, injures himself, and doesn't hold on to it after the fact. That's just not the kind of center fielder that Nimmo is. So, yeah, ideally, you'd like to have a team that does all those three things correctly. But, you know, if you haven't put together the perfect team, then, yeah, the thing that gets squeezed a lot of the time is the defense. Because you always think that's the thing you're going to be able to skate from. That's the thing you're going to be able to cover up, you know, by not allowing, you know, when you have a good pitching staff and when you have a good offense. But run prevention is not just pitching. Run prevention is the defensive side. And that's just something that the Mets just haven't focused on. I mean, they got Lindor, who's an elite defender, which is great. You know, you want an elite defender at shortstop. But otherwise up the middle, you know, McCann had been doing a better job early. And in center field, you know, Nimmo is, you try to, he's kind of passable. You try to get by with him. So, yeah, it's a fundamental flaw of the team. I think there's times I look at Dom in left, and I see he's made plays where he's put the work in. I've seen him make a couple nice plays, you know, playing balls off the wall where he's done a good job with. And then other times I've seen him, you know, not misjudge balls, but just doesn't have the technique or the instinct, you know, to make a play that, yeah, it's a double, but if you have a better left fielder, it's caught. You know, those are the differences there. It's not a glaring error that he makes, but he just doesn't get to a ball or make a play that a regular good left fielder would make. But those are the sacrifices you make. In left field, you stick a guy who's not particularly a great defender who can help you offensively, and that's where they're at with somebody like Dom. So in other areas, you know, Pete Alonso wasn't supposed to be a good defender. People say he can never play first base. He's done a pretty good job at first base. You know, I've seen him make a lot of good plays over there. You can tell he's really worked hard to get better. So I think there's room for improvement. I've seen Jeff McNeil make some great plays at second base recently that he's done a good job with. So I'm not going to condemn this team as an awful defensive team forever going forward, but there's areas that need to improve, and hopefully on those unearned runs especially, that they can polish that up some.
Sam, last word on defense?
Well, I was going to just vouch for up the middle, because Jeff McNeil and Francisco Lindor have combined for some brilliant double plays over the course of this road trip. It is they've saved innings, and, you know, if you know, or especially early, they've been saving innings early, which means they've been saving games in many ways. Pete Alonso has a great stretch. I think other than just being good at seeming to pick up the ball in the dirt wherever it comes and however fast it's coming, he seems to really make sure that he's getting as out as possible, which of course is going to impact how quickly it is called out. I don't know whether he's worked with Keith. Keith was obviously, I never watched Keith, but, you know, anybody who's watched Keith says he was the best they've ever seen there, next to Gil Hodges, of course. So, you know, I think that this team has a long way to go, but I don't think, especially when it comes to, David just said, Dom Smith has made some strides. I think Michael Conforto, as Rich has pointed out, is much better than people ever gave him credit for or ever give him credit for out there. And, you know, right now, I also want to mention that Kevin Pillar, while holding down the defense, is also turning out to be a pretty a relevant part of the offensive side right now. He is making himself a very effective part of this team right now. So hopefully both Pillar and Villar, he had a little bit of a defensive miscue today, VR, but he's also been just like, yes, last night he put in a game. He put in an absolute game where his speed, he is trying to basically make the conversation be that VR is back to what he was early on. I believe it was with the Brewers. So defensively, they have a long way to go, but I do think they need to get a little bit more credit in certain spots.
Well done by you. Great mention, Sam. Gentlemen, thank you all for a wonderful conversation this evening. Unless anybody has any other comments or rude remarks, we'll jump right into our final word. Going once, going twice, and here we go. This is the Metsian Podcast. Our guest this evening, has been New York Newsday's David Lennon. Sir, thank you for allowing us to go into extra innings, first and foremost. Your time spent with us this evening is greatly appreciated. I personally am a big fan of your work. And again, your insights and clarity into the Metsian situation, we thank you very kindly. I will give you a taste of the final word. Go right ahead, sir.
No, I was just going to say it was my pleasure. I always like talking baseball. And I was honored that you guys gave me the invite to come on your show. It was I had a good time.
Thank you. Thank you very kindly. The pleasure is ours. I will give you a taste of our final word. I will start with Rich. Sir, your final word.
Well, it's a couple of words. Remember that old TV show where at the end they would say, well, to please whoever it is, stand up. You know, they had to guess who the right person was. Well, mine is, well, the real New York Mets, please stand up. Is this a 500 team? Okay. And that's the way it's going to be. You know, Steve Cohen said 3 to 5 years. This isn't the year. Or is this a team that is treading water for now? We'll get some guys hot. We'll get a couple of pieces back in the rotation and really take off. I don't know, but at some point I'd like the real New York Mets to please stand up.
Mr. Lennon, around here at the Metsian Podcast, we affectionately call them shameless plugs. Please, in your own words, tell us what you're doing, where we can find it.
Well, I mean, obviously you can find my work at newsday.com. That's easy enough to track down. And on Twitter, I'm at DP Lennon. So I'm easy enough to find on Twitter as well, which I usually put a link to most of my stories and, well, pretty much all my stories and columns and whatever else I'm interested in. And that's all that's going on at the moment. No books to plug or anything for the moment. Next time I have a book to plug or something, I'll be sure to dial you up so we can get on and talk about it.
And if you don't mind, your final words for the Metsville listeners.
For me, I would say hang in there. I know you guys are a passionate bunch. And I experience that passion on both sides, whether it's on Twitter or whether it's talking to Mets fans. So, you know, the season's fun either way, right? It's watching baseball. It's I can see there's plenty of things to get angry about, but also a lot of fun stuff too. So I'd say it's always good to keep things in perspective, but I know among Mets fans that's impossible to do.
Thank you again very kindly. Sam, has become my custom, I'm going to hand off to you. I'm going to issue my final word. First, happy birthday, Willie Mays. Minor League Baseball is back. They're back on the field. Congratulations to them. It's been a long time for those guys. Let's go Syracuse. Let's go Binghamton. And, of course, let's go Brooklyn Cyclones. And I'll leave it at that. Sam, take us home.
Well, thank you, Mike. And again, thank you, David Lennon and Rich Spirago, for joining us this evening. What is there to say? You know, I think I have to go with the Dark Knight. Will the Dark Knight rise next week in Gotham when he returns and is online to pitch against the New York Mets? That is going to be quite the story, and what the narrative will be for the New York Mets remains to be seen. He will certainly be pumped, and the Mets better be prepared one way or another to not embarrass themselves, really, as it goes. Once more, let me just say thank you to our guest, David Lennon. Thank you, of course, to my co-conspirators in this podcast, Michael Colon and Rich Spirago. And, of course, thank you to all you listeners out there. There's only one way, as always, to finish this, and that is let's go Mets. Take care, everybody. Enjoy the week. Stay safe out there. Stay healthy out there. Have a great one.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, David.